circus is back in town at Man United. I am flabbergasted.
These players don't run, they don't sprint, they don't close down, they don't walk.
Tim, we're all sitting here and I know we have to analyse the game. Analyse it till the cows come home. You do your job.
I don't like to see all that rubbish.
Big boy stuff. Forget this laughing and joking rubbish. That job's for the boys, you know, you're pals with this or the chief executive. Who's giving out these contracts?
Leopards don't change their spots. There's too many bluffers at this club.
I would definitely take the captaincy off.
My job depends on these guys.
Then you're in trouble.
I think there is an element now at Man United, kind of job for the boys there, you know. No, wink, wink, look after each other, know the right people. At this moment in time, Man United are competing for fourth position. That's the best it's going to be for a while.
And Man United are in bigger trouble than I even think, and I think they're in huge trouble.
Hey, lads, remember who we are, we're Man United, don't forget that. We're here to win, and we always knew that the club was going to suffer when Alex Ferguson left. But I don't think for 1 minute I would have thought Man United would have fallen so far behind.
I've said for years, if you have a chance to sign for Man United, go for it. But my mind has changed definitely over the last couple of years.
Hello and welcome to the first Football Family of 2024. I am your host, David Snaid. And yes, today is Monday. If you've been a regular listener over the last couple of years, we hope that you will keep the faith, perhaps even give us that vote of confidence, dreaded or otherwise, by sticking with us as we now bring matters for 24 hours from the usual Tuesday release. It's not all changed though, and you'll be glad to hear that Gavin Cooney and Shane Keegan are here with me to help get you tucked into your football family comfort blanket. Although, Shane, of course, there is some change. How are you dealing with life as a GAA man, purely and simply?
Ah, well, I've always been half that anyway, but I'll never know. I don't like that reference now, a GAA man, purely. I'm not purely.
We're getting off to a good start. We're getting off to a good start. I like
No. I don't have to be a League of Ireland manager to still be involved in football. Not happy with that. But, I'm enjoying not driving down to Cork three times a week at the moment. That is the upside, all right. But no doubt I will miss all the rest of it, that's for sure.
But this time of year, like in terms of the stresses and the hassles and organising, well, pre-season will be underway, trying to get players. Has there been any party over the last little while that's been like, oh, did I make the right decision?
They're the exact opposite, to be honest with you. I'm not trying to play the martyr here now or anything, or I'm not looking for any sympathy, but I actually tallied it up from Monday to Sunday of last week. I did 62 hours in my day job, and it just brought me to the reality of, how did you possibly think you were going to be able to juggle this with League of Ireland? I was out every night of the week with my day job last week, and Cove Ramblers were back training last week. They played their first game there at the weekend in the Munster Senior Cup. So it just kind of hit home the reality of, like, it was a decision that had to be made. I just, straight away last week would have been an absolute impossibility for me, you know.
I was saying, we're 15 days into the new year, but it did only take me a couple of seconds to annoy you there. But yeah, I don't know. Which, I'm taking that some kind of saying, we're picking up where we left off, so happy days.
Actually, it took you a lot less. I was already annoyed by your new hair.
New hair?
Yeah, I haven't seen this. What's going on? I haven't seen this hairstyle before. It's very...
Shane, I sat across from you with my hair shorter than this just before Christmas.
Did you?
I had literally got... Oh, this is actually longer than what it was before Christmas, because the greys are coming back into it now.
I don't know. It looks different. You look like a different person. You look like... You look like one of Nidja's cronies from Love Hate or something. Maybe it's more the hoodie than that. Maybe it's more the hoodie than the haircut there. I'm not sure.
What? Oh, the Lacoste hoodie. Got a good deal. January, but what I would say, you're saying about Nidge's cronies. Do you remember that Love Hate when Nidge had King Nidge on his runners? Well, I got a pair of Crocs over Christmas actually, and I must say these yokes have changed my life.
Oh man, I thought it was the grey hairs that was making you seem old, but now that you're like, oh, I'm a Croc man now.
Would you be a fan of Crocs? Would you wear Crocs? No,
I've never worn a pair. I'm not against them, you know.
I'll be honest, it was never something that was on my radar whatsoever until I slipped on a pair just randomly. I was like, ah, oh, they're actually decent. You know what I mean? They're better than flip-flops. So I wear flip-flops a lot. But like, no, these are, especially in the days when you're working from home sometimes and you don't want to have to actually, I don't know, runners, shoes, like this. You can tell this is a tangent coming out of nowhere because I'm not sure where I'm quite going with it. But the Crocs, genuinely.
But you want a shoe that you can put on without having to stoop. Like you can just slip your foot into, you know? And I know there's those Skechers being advertised by Jamie Redknapp as the ones you can just... Yeah, I don't know though. I don't buy the advertising gimmick of it that, you know, you can so easily slip your feet into them. I don't buy that. Whereas it's obvious with a Croc.
Yeah. New Year's resolution, the New Year's resolution not to go off on wild tangents on the podcast didn't last very long, did it?
I never made such a runs. But what I will also say, Shane, you're a man who now wants a more comfortable life since you stepped away from the League of Ireland. I thought these crocs now be right up your street.
Brilliantly brought back around. Oh, I love it.
I know. But like as you would have heard as well from at the start of that, like Sean, the good young man Sean Hussey carefully put together that little Roy Keane kind of audio start. And it was interesting like what you were saying about that with United in terms of players, he would have always said, well, if you want to be a top player, United is still a club for you. And getting away from that, do you know what I mean? That he actually isn't quite feeling that. I'll be honest, I'm surprised it's taken him this long. For someone who supposedly is able to, talks about bluffers and all the rest of it, I would have thought, Jesus, that's something that he would have thought a long while ago in terms of United. Like, surely no one could have been saying for the last number of years, you would say, yeah, any real kind of serious professional wanting to go and win trophies should be looking at United.
Well, I'm still seeing it as a major feather in my cap that, if it stays going the way it is, that at the start of the season, seems obvious now, but I got dogs abuse online at the start of the season when I said United wouldn't make the Champions League. Because at the time they were, I don't know, third in the betting with the bookies, like, so they were absolutely expected to be top four, but... I got her. And it wasn't even my Spurs tinted glasses. I didn't have Spurs to be top four either, so I didn't. But I kind of thought this could be a tough season for Eric Ten Hag, and it's certainly proven that way at the moment.
Jim Ratcliffe was at Old Trafford, obviously, to see the 2-2 draw, and he was actually gave a kind of an impromptu press briefing to some of the journalists who were there. So basically, the main point being coming out of that is that he expects the 25% minority stake to be ratified by mid-February, by which point the transfer window is going to be closed. So you mentioned there, Cheyenne, about online. There'll be some fans online who will have ceased to take any notice of what actually happens on the pitch. And we will be in the relentless tick of what looks to be another march to glory for Man City. There is plenty more for us that we are going to cover this afternoon, from more financial fair play gloom for Everton and also Nottingham Forest, state of play for the Eurostars in the Championship. There's obviously the small matter of the senior men's manager appointment. One kind of high profile departure from the FAI, especially internally, recently, or impending departure, and obviously as well the start of that 2024 League of Ireland season, which Shane has absolutely nothing to do with, but we will still ask him for his opinion on. Gav, what was your take on the United match yesterday?
Yeah, I thought Spurs were by far the better team. I mean, speaking of Crocs, the fact that Spurs have so many injured players made it all the more impressive. The fact that they pretty much dominated the game, I thought, you know, they're missing their first choice midfield, all three of them. They're missing their best player in Son. They're also missing Kulusevski, who was really missed because I thought Brennan Johnson was really poor and so wasteful as the right-sided attacker. And it's a very, very unflattering comparison for Erik ten Hag to see... the impact that Ange Postecoglou has had at Tottenham, and he's had it in a very short space of time. Like, the fact that Spurs went to Old Trafford with half a team and played like that now is a surprise to absolutely nobody, because that's what they've been doing all year. And the fact that he's got this very obvious identity and style, and has everyone not just bought into it but practicing it so quickly, is massively impressive for him. And it makes Ten Hag look really bad, because United, I thought the goals, Hoyland and Rashford's goals, were really good, and they obviously have that individual quality, but as in terms of team structure, in terms of identity, in terms of approach, it's all over the shop. You know, there's no consistency, there's no real obvious plan to kind of dominate possession or build up from the back. They're defensively abysmal on set pieces. They were poor out of possession in terms of pressing as well. Look how easily they were carved open by that for that second goal, the Bentancourt equaliser. It honestly looked like a team playing. United looked like, you know, like walking football, for like that community project that brings 6-year-olds back out playing football for the sake of, you know, getting in touch with other people in their community. That looks like what United were doing on that Spurs goal. So I thought it was a good draw for Manchester United, but I basically think they're not very good at anything, and this season is a total write-off. And I'd be surprised if Ten Hag survives into the start of next season.
They're not very good at anything is a great line.
But like, honestly, sorry, you're a football coach. You'll have a better appreciation of these things than me. And I know you're looking at that match yesterday from a Spurs point of view, but like on United, did you see anything that they did well?
No, I agree with you 100%. I think Gary Neville was in commentary, wasn't it? I think it was him that said this is a team that has consistently relied on moments for any form of success over the last. And he actually, to be fair to him, he listed off more than Ten Hag. He said he listed off two or three managers and said they've consistently relied on moments from individuals through the stewardship of quite a few different managers now over the last few years. And he was basically talking about the Hoyland goal as being a moment, and then I think he was talking about the Rashford miss at the time as being a moment where they didn't execute it. But basically he was saying because there's no style of play, like, again, for all the grief he gets, it tends to be it's Fernandez is the one who comes up with those moments more consistently than any other player, no doubt about it. I thought he was the shining light for them again yesterday, even despite not being at his very best. I did think he was very
well. He's the best player. Like, he's United's best player.
Oh, by a million miles.
Which, but also kind of illustrates where the problem is with United as well in terms of what he's at. Like, in terms of
But no, they were, like you say, they were absolutely. They're just not. How do you describe them? Like, there is no way of describing them. They're nothing. Like, they really are nothing. Now, the only
they draw the game. I would say that. Like.
Yeah.
And it was the point that Gav makes, I think, is the one more so than that, is just how kind of ropey looked for it, how strong Spurs were at set pieces. A lot of the possession they could cut open for the goal, but that's the only, in terms of what was good, the only thing. Maybe it would have been a case if Spurs had their full strength team in terms of, especially the attackers with Son or Kulusevski, they would have maybe, could have been a different game. But it did, maybe again, I could be totally wrong on this, which was my perception watching the game. It did feel as if United were kind of happy for Spurs to have the ball where they did, purely because they knew at the top end of the pitch, maybe that same quality wasn't there. Now, the second goal was brilliant in terms of the touch from Bentancur to get in and then finish, but it did feel as if it was going to be a set piece that would win the game for Spurs. That was my kind of looking at it. I was thinking, Jesus, every time Porto was taking a corner or he got a free kick in a dangerous area, this is going
to
be trouble.
But David, like, as a Man United, surely to God, Manchester United fans cannot be happy at a home draw against the Tottenham side, who Alex Ferguson obviously used to take the absolute piss out of, and literally one, after the back four, one of the rest of the team would have made the starting lineup if players were fit and available. One. So it was about as B team as a B team gets from the midfield up for Spurs. Mm. And yet,
no, and that's the thing, but also that's the point as well, in the sense of, like, it's not the Alex Ferguson team beforehand. Do you know what I mean? If that was United of that time that played that way, like, Jesus, that's like, what's going on? But do you know what I mean? This is just a symptom of, like, what the Keane point at the end and what kind of the points that Keane had made in that clip that Sean put together. Like, this is just kind of a symptom over the last number of years of a team in moments who were in probably the worst period for a long time. Like, it's at the point now where you're looking at it, you wouldn't bet on United finishing the top half this season in terms of where other clubs are beginning to get to as well. Do you know what I mean? As a United supporter, like, you can't be angry with a 2-2 draw at home to Spurs, even a depleted Spurs. You just can't be.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, I have to say. I don't think United look massively better than Newcastle or Chelsea. I think United will finish in the top half, but, like, it could be, I mean, it wouldn't be surprised if it was somewhere between 8th and 10th, to be honest with you. And they will get better when they get players back. I mean, Martinez returned. Luke Shaw is an important player. Why was Wan-Bissaka at left back? I didn't understand that at all. Dalot's at right back, but I suppose Dalot's at least got more experience playing left back. It's for another weird decision. But, like, when you're talking there about, you know, comparing and contrasting Ferguson's teams with this United team, and that's entirely correct. But, you know, if that was the Mourinho team of 2017, so that's 7 years ago now, they would have played Spurs the exact same way in which United tried to play them, yesterday. Sit back and try to hit them on the counter. And it's no wonder then, like, all these things are connected. Like, there's no obvious style of player identity, and as a result, the players who are recruited are all kind of awkward parts. Will they fit there? There's loads of stop gaps right across the squad. Johnny Evans starting again at the weekend. Amrabat's away now, but like, he's another stop gap. It's filled with them, you know, and that's because the United have just completely failed to come up with one overall vision and identity of play, and recruit players and stick to that. And like, that was what I thought they were going to get with Ten Hag. I was impressed by him in his first season for his ability to compromise and throw out a lot of his ideas, because he plainly didn't have the players to suit it, with Ronaldo still there and Sancho and so forth. But you know, he's now been manager for, well, this is, what is this, his fourth transfer window, and he's like, I mean, the recruitment is all over the shop. You know, you sign Antony, and then last summer, and then this year you're talking about being the best counter-attacking team in the world. Well, there's a reason why Antony didn't start yesterday, is because he's too slow to play in the counter-attack for that style of game. So the whole thing is just a mess, and the only hope for United fans is that the Ratcliffe thing works out and works better in practice than it looks on paper, and that he can affect that kind of overall change. But it's a long and it's a hard road.
But that point, and you all know it is, and this is before we get back onto talking about Spurs and suppose where Postecoglou has them, because I saw the point made, well, can that actually be, can he maintain what he's doing? I'm surprised, because I think he clearly can. But like, tell you which, I made this point previously, just that, like, sometimes it is just getting in the right couple of players. Do you know what I mean? It might, like, things can change very drastically in football. Even like, look what's happened at United in terms of last season, from the point of winning the Carabao Cup, and what Gav's point, where it looked as if, well, do you know what? There's times where United did look very strong, even in Premier League games against teams, and seemed to have a sense that, well, teams are on the right road. But it doesn't, when you have the right, say, coaching in there and the right manager, but then you also have the right players, it doesn't take an awful lot to change the whole dynamics of a team, because all it would take is the right couple of players coming in. Then all of a sudden you might get more out of players who are already there as well. From the point of view of what you were saying earlier, Shane, but looking at what United happened, they didn't weren't that right, or not right, but maybe not really well, which is hard to argue with. Where would be the key areas for you then? You're thinking, well, if, not so much a quick fix, but something that could make a big difference very quickly. What are the areas for United that you're thinking this has to get sorted? Number one, what's the, like?
I genuinely don't know how to answer, because there's so many areas. Like, I suppose, can they go and find a player that Casemiro was for the first 6 months when he arrived? You know, if you could find now who that is, because we'll come on to Spurs and I'm probably going to say the same thing, but like, a player who wants to be on the ball, a player who's constantly demanding the ball, a player who can use the ball deeper now, deeper than Bruno Fernandes. So a kind of a six or an eight who's able to grab a game by the scruff of the neck. I mean, there is still quality there, but there just doesn't seem to be any form of cohesiveness. I don't know if signings are the answer. Obviously signings will help, but like, what? Like, there's no one signing that's going to change them from not being cohesive to being cohesive. Like, this is more of a, I honestly, like, if you were asking me the question you've asked is, what's the one thing that they could do to enact the biggest change? The one thing they could do to enact the biggest change is change the manager.
Well, that's, yeah.
And I know you'll have so many United fans saying, but should we do keep changing the manager? And nothing seems to work. But unfortunately, when it doesn't work, you're left with no option but to change the manager yet again until you find the manager that does. Like, surely to God, they've got it wrong so many times on the managerial front that the law of averages dictates they're eventually going to get it bloody right.
And even on that, Gab, as well, again, I wrote this just at the weekend about it, even tying in with Sancho going to Dortmund, there's like, United fans would have said, well, do you know what? Back Ten Hag and trust his judgment in terms of understanding personalities and the right people to get in and who should be rooted out. But then, you've already mentioned him, say the likes of Antony, but also other players, when he has had such an influence on actually bringing players in, and you see that some of these players don't seem to be good enough, that kind of then lessens his authority a little bit in terms of, well, that faith and trust in the personalities and understanding what's required, can you actually back it? And that point about the manager, it does come a point, especially when you've got new people coming in who are going to be running the football operation. Like, Jamie Carragher wrote this, didn't he, in his own column in the Telegraph the weekend, like, reflecting on his time at Liverpool. they tend to want to get their own people in, or the people who they see. So, like, I don't think it's beyond the possibility that Ten Hag is now, like, his contract is up at the end of next season. Like, he has to show something now to these new people who are going to be making decisions, that he is someone they can work with.
Ah, massively. I go back to Ferguson's kind of farewell note in 2013 to the crowd, as your job now is to back the new manager. And the problem is, United have done that, and they've backed the managers far too much, but then not had the bravery to stick with them beyond kind of any kind of medium term crisis. So, like, you've got this squad, and like Ten Hag only recently finished kind of trying to get rid of the guys that Mourinho had around, you know, and he's actually still not done, because Martial is somehow still there. And this is one of the areas in which obviously it looks really bad for Ten Hag now, because he also owns the recruitment side of things and the failures there, like the Antony thing. I don't think he'll ever recover for that. When we're reading the big, long Athletic read after Ten Hag leaves, you'll read Antony's name in the first three paragraphs. But the problem for United is the very kind of weak and reactive leadership above the manager. You know, they basically don't get a plan and they don't stick to it. And that's because I think it's harder to do at Man United than any other club, right? Especially in England. Because of the size of it, because of the number of influential former pros that they've got in the press, and because of the noise that's whistling around the club all the time. It was what Cruyff called the intorno at Barcelona. So it's hard not to react to that. But United do seem exquisitely sensitive to it when you read about their, you know, fan metric graphs and all that. Like, how the fuck are you meant to run a club when you're reading fan sentiment online? It would drive you completely mad. And like, we've had concrete examples of this not working, you know, like chase Frankie de Jong for the first full summer then of before Ten Hag's first match, after Ten Hag had been appointed, and you don't get him. Okay, disappointing, fair enough. Then they didn't get anyone. Then they lost 4-0 to Brentford, and then, okay, let's spend 70 million on Casemiro on a 5-year deal. And it's going to cost you more to get rid of him after year two, when you know his legs are gone, you know. So that's an example of the panic and how reactive things are, where there's no coherent plan. There's no, like, okay, there's going to be short-term pain for long-term gain. All the moment is just short-term pain that's parlaying into medium-term pain that's now been parlayed into long-term pain. It's been a decade since United were really relevant here. So it's, Ten Hag will go. I think he'll go in the summer. I think the job he's doing this season is not up to scratch, despite the turmoil off the field in terms of this long sale of the club that has ended up in the sale of a chunk of a club. And the injuries as well provide some level of mitigation, but the issues, to make a blindingly obvious point, are far beyond them.
But at least Marcus Rashford silences doubters. He made sure that he gave it all that, wasn't it, when he scored his goal, and all the people talking. Spurs, though, Shane, Postecoglou, like, I'll be honest, at the start of the match, I was thinking, especially when Højlund scored, and maybe a little bit of the joy they were having, but Spurs regrouped very, very quickly. They pretty much got a grip of that game within a matter of minutes of falling behind.
Yeah. And look, they say every team should be a mirror of their manager. And I suppose Postecoglou does strike you as a guy with a lot of kind of conviction in himself and mental strength. And I think Tottenham showed traits of that the other day. With the amount of injuries that are there, you go 1-0 down at Old Trafford, I think it would have been very, very easy just to let that game get away from them. But they responded really, really well. Now, there's a couple of things on this, right? So, like, we're still talking about a very relatively small sample size here, okay? Like, he's, you know, half a season in. That's, you can be made look foolish very, very easily. We're speaking about Ange in a way that we spoke about Erik ten Hag after his first few months in charge of Man United. Like, that is reality. This is how we were very impressed with Ten Hag early on. The differences in why it would seem a bit more lasting this time is that there is such a definitive style of play. It's very, very obvious to an extreme almost at times. It is high risk, high reward. But like you said, again, just to go back to your question about United, who do they bring in? So we don't know who they bring in, because we don't know what they're supposed to be doing. So how the hell are we meant to know who they should bring in? Whereas if you look at the Spurs signing this week of Dragosin, I mean, it's an absolute no-brainer. Spurs play with a ridiculously high back line. That is the way they will always go about it. So he has went out and bought a centre-half who not only can defend and looks good, but most importantly, is lightning quick and is therefore able to run, defend all that space in the half behind him when his team are pressing so high. So there, the point here is, I don't know whether Dragson is going to be a success or not, but he fit a very, very clear criteria of what is required for a Tottenham player in that position. I'm not sure I could give you the clear criteria of what is required for any Man United player in any position. So the fact that that style of play is so definite, obviously it's exciting from a coaching point of view that it's so new. You know, the positions, I know we've spoken about it before, so I won't harp on about it too much, but the positions Podro and the doggy pick up are different than anything I've ever seen. Anywhere, to be honest with you, I've never seen it done. I've seen the fullback who comes inside and into the kind of six position, but never seen the fullback who comes inside and into the 10 position. It was again with the coach's hat on. I know it was only a 5 minute period, a little bit more than 5 minutes, but it did. A manager of a Cove Ramblers team that played with a back three for pretty much the entire season. It was interesting to see him go to the back three for the last few minutes against United. He's now got three centre-halves that he would have complete and utter faith in. Can that whole thing of the wide defenders coming in field, can that work in a 3-5-2 as much as it can work in a back four? I think that's going to be really interesting to see. Does he stick with a 4-4-2 and just say, back four, I should say. Does he stick with a back four and say, okay, one of the three of you is going to be left out every week? Or is he actually going to try and change Spurs now to a three centre-half approach? And have Udogie and Poro coming in field from wing back.
Does that, sorry for being a bit just asking this question, does that lessen the risk in terms of playing the high line when you have three centre backs? In terms of, is that like in terms, or because of the position and whatever, like does it almost make it, they, I don't know, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I do think there's an extra element of cover there. I like three at the back, so I'd like to see him have a go at it and see what he would do with a team that plays with a back three. I think it could be very interesting from me as a coach's point of view. I'd love to see how that would evolve or what he'd try and do with that. I'd be very surprised if it happens because he's been so married to the way that we're going about it at the moment. It does, in theory, probably change everything, really, in terms of the positions that everybody picks up. But I'd love to see him have a crack at it, if for no other reason than to expand my learning nearly as a coach from watching him. But again, I'll you know, to go full circle and come back to it, it's just chalk and cheese in terms of the definitive style of play as against a team that have absolutely no recognisable style of play. And even though there's not a million miles apart from each other in the table, and even though I might be made sound foolish because he will have poor periods, and maybe in however long Ten Hag is there, maybe in a year and a half's time, we'll be looking for him to be gone. I don't know, but at the moment, it's intrigue.
There are probably people listening at this point of the podcast. Well, hopefully there'll be people listening, but definitely listening, thinking, or you just stop talking about Man United. But that point you've made there about, I want to just go back to it because it's an interesting one, and it makes me think, like, yeah, it's been very poor this season for United, but if in, and this is to both of you, so whoever wants to jump in. But like, so if say Ineos now and Dave Brailsford and whoever it is that comes in as the sporting director, the German Blanc or whatever, they decide, right, this is where we're going, this is how we want to play. And they feel, well, do you know what? Ten Hag has shown previously at Ajax that he can play a certain way. If the manager then actually has a proper structure ahead on top, above him, to get the people in, like what was mentioned there about chasing Frankie de Jong for half the window, then getting hockeyed in a few early games, panicking, and then buying Casemiro, right? So two polar opposite players. Not that he deserves to have the season as a write-off, but like, if they decide, well, do you know what? This, we feel as if Ten Hag has shown previously he's someone who can play to a certain style. We're going to make sure we get those type of players in. Like what you've mentioned just there, Shane, about Dagestan coming in. Like, that's a player who 100% fits where Ange Postecoglou wants to play. But on the flip side, even that, let's say, for example, Postecoglou gets nicked by someone else and goes, then you have to, like, this is where this element comes in of buying. It looks smart now because he's a player who fits that profile, but if the manager changes and you can't get in the same type of manager, then there's a bit of a folly to that, a little bit, in terms of you've bought someone specifically for that system. But the going back to that is, with Ten Hag, would it be a case of, well, actually, he deserves at least one full season of working under people who are far more competent at getting the players in for him that he needs?
I don't know, yeah, but the problem is that a lot of the players that have arrived, most of them are the players that Ten Hag wanted. You know, I mean, his fingerprints are over this squad too much now for him to be able to wash his hands of it, you know. And I think that not enough has been shown so far of any kind of coherent style at all. You know, he's got players in for one style and then talked about changing it this season. Nothing wrong with wanting to be the best counter-attacking team in the world. But, you know, you should have recruited for that, not recruited for one way and decide to flip the other way. So I would expect him to, you know, if this thing, it could be another month or whatever before things are legally signed and everything, like everyone officially has their feet under the desk and so forth. And why get rid of him mid-season? Because the most important thing is who you replace him with, not necessarily when you get rid of him. But I would be surprised, you know, like as a manager, you're always under pressure. You've no credit in the bank when the person who's going to make the decision to sack you is not the person that appointed you. Ten Hag isn't putting forward a very persuasive case to be kept on in that situation.
That's fair enough. That's a good point.
Don't think there's anything I can add of value there, to be honest.
So there was another Premier League milestone, if they do count, for Seamus Coleman. I think we have to consider Seamus Coleman to allow it. He's now Everton's most caps. You don't get caps, so how would you best describe it? Just most appearances, I suppose, is the most obvious and basic way of doing it. But his next few appearances could possibly be in the Championship next season, Gav.
Yeah. you know, he did say it afterwards that we're a mid-table team, really, just by the points deduction, so they have to show that. They're in a slough of pretty poor form at the moment, Everton, really. I think performances have been better than results, from which they can probably take a bit of solace. I don't know how they lost to Spurs before Christmas, and, you know, they had to battle it out against Aston Villa, but Dominic Calvert-Lewin missed an absolute sitter at one-on-one. So, yeah, unfortunately, for Everton, and now we're expecting news today, according to The Athletic, that they're going to be charged again with a financial fair play breach themselves in Nottingham Forest for the FFP rules. And I kind of, like, they're quite controversial, obviously, these financial fair play rules, and Martin Samuel of The Times has been writing this column every 6 months on and off for the last 3 or 4 years, that they're unfair, that they're protectionist, that these rules were brought in by the cartel to stop new people arriving and spending their way to the elite. But, you know, teams have still managed to arrive and spend their way to the elite. And I think these rules have made the whole season so much more interesting, to be honest. Like, I mean, now we've seen Newcastle are really restricted in what they can spend. They have, you know, a limitless supply of money, but they can't use any of it because they haven't brought in enough money and earned enough over recent years. And, like, anything that puts some financial controls on clubs and forces them to get creative in ways outside of just spending their way out of trouble, I think is really good. It makes everything so much more interesting. Like, United can only sign loan players in January because they've overspent, which is a good thing from kind of a moral point of view as well. Like, no one should be able to spend £83 million on Antony and not have any repercussions for it. So
Antony gets slaughtered, doesn't he? But you know what's actually interesting? You wouldn't think it. There's only a month in age between him and Sancho. You know, one is the precocious young talent who needs an arm around the shoulder and needs to be comforted and needs to be brought out, and the other one is just a complete waster, you know?
I genuinely don't know which is which there.
You don't know, to be honest. But I enjoyed your piece, though, that point you make about why financial, the headline that was on why financial fair play is one of the best things about the Premier League. Because I would agree, in the sense of, even, I remember, like, Shane, you were talking about getting abuse when you made a point. Like, I was saying, when, like, people were seen to be outraged that Everton got punished. But, like, at the same time, they got punished because they knew what they were doing. Even if, though, it's like, yeah, they were cooperating. Like, just because you cooperate doesn't mean you get off scot-free. In terms of it, do you know what I mean? It's like laying out the... And don't get me wrong, like, City looked very rampant against Newcastle, especially when Kevin De Bruyne came on, and we can talk about... But we're not going to talk about their 115 charges now. But, like, that's kind of looming over everything here as well. So, like, do you know what I mean? Like, this is where it's going to be... I don't know when that's going to actually 100% get sorted out and seems to be... But, like, I think you're right in what you say. Like, the time of... Or the days of being able to just like spend totally beyond means. And it's a different kind of case, but you see some of what's happening with Reading and owners, what's happened there, and how clubs can be absolutely decimated. There needs to be that kind of regulation, Gav.
But can I just throw out, like, the only question I have on this is, and obviously I'm nowhere near as clued in on it, but, like, is this going to apply to Everton and Forest because they don't have the super, super wealth that means they can just tie it all up in court, whereas, like, are City ever going to be punished? Like, I find it hard to believe that City are actually ever going to be punished because they're just too rich and just too capable of fighting any... They're like the parallel of the Donegal GA County Board. They're just too clever.
It does seem to be slightly different in the sense that with Everton and with Forest, it's in black and white about the losses, because it's about the profit and sustainability as well. Like, it's not like the City thing is slightly different in terms of its regarding contracts and its regarding different sponsorships that have come in, etc., etc. Whereas it does seem to be a bit more black and white, and they've held their hands up to it in terms of how much they've actually lost and the money they've lost.
It's just the process takes forever, and the process obviously takes too long. This is the problem with it all. Like, the Everton got deducted 10 points for issues going back to, you know, in a 3-year period that culminated with last season. But there was something like 40,000 documents produced, and Everton had one charge, you know, so you can imagine how much process and how much has to be got through with the Man City thing. Like, I know people who pay kind of casual attention to it will be like, oh, you punish Everton and Man City have 115 charges that they've not been punished. Like, that whole process is ongoing, like with the City thing. But, you know, final arguments, you read in the Mail last year that final arguments and a decision might not be made till the 25-26 season, which is a farce, you know. Like, I mean, the whole thing is hanging over the league. And even if we were expecting news on Forest and Everton today, it's not arrived at the time of recording, you know, that might not be resolved until next season, which again is totally unsatisfactory. Like, things have to be resolved so much more quickly. But the broad principle of it and the idea that the teams have to act smarter, I think, is a good thing. And it's a means of rewarding the smarter clubs. Like, Brighton are, you know, Brighton only spent, Forest spent 22 million more than Brighton last summer. It's not that much, but Brighton are nowhere near being in financial fair play trouble because they're so well run, because their recruitment is smart. And, you know, the game shouldn't all be about money. I know it broadly has been at Premier League level, but anything that rewards people spending smartly rather than spending excessively is a great thing.
I actually had no idea that Divock Origi play for Nottingham Forest.
The list of guys they've signed. I mean, the odds were, like, were we recording this in England, one of the three of us would have been signed by them by just to go off the national average. But obviously, you know, Andrew Omobamadeli plays for them allegedly. But although, well, plays, is on the books there. Mm. We'll hopefully get a loan deal now. But, you know, the list of guys that they've signed is bonkers. And, like, loads of fullbacks, loads of wingbacks, loads of guys in the same feckin' position. Like, it's just a complete mess.
I wonder if any of them could do a job for United on loan. Kevin De Bruyne is back, Shane. Is that why you have such a big grin on your face as well?
He was ridiculous, wasn't he? My God, 4.5 minutes or whatever he was on the field. Look, he's just an absolute joy to watch. Like, he's just an absolute joy to watch. It's like every time he gets, imagine playing against him, you'd just be shitting yourself. Every time he gets the ball, you'd be like, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? You're just like, he just refuses to do the simple, straightforward thing. It's like, I'm going to have a look and see if I can come up with something here to carve you open every time I get the ball. And, like, whatever hope. I think, like, if I was an opposition manager, like, watching that cameo the other day, I'd be like, okay, how can we even fool ourselves into thinking we're going to win the Premier League this year? Like, he's just going to take them shooting up gears, like, in, like, no time. Absolutely.
Sorry, shooting up what?
Dead gears, not gear.
Oh my
Niji.
God.
Oh my God. I thought we just heard about the 116th charge there.
But he was, like, wasn't he? He was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. And, like, they've done extremely well to kind of limit his absence and throw Haaland's in on top of it. But from a competitive point of view, I would argue you would actually like to have seen the other teams really capitalise on his absence while he was out. Because I would love to see, can Kevin De Bruyne returning to Man City and Haaland about to return to Man City, can they reel in a team who are like 10, 12 points clear But unfortunately, nobody's managed to even create that scenario, which I think means it's going to be a cakewalk.
And I think they're, after that Newcastle win, because it was very impressive, and obviously you could even see it with Guardiola, but they're now 3 games into their customary 16-17 game winning run, now it seems.
And I think the, am I right to say the only top half team they play between now and the 3rd of March in Man United is Chelsea, who are 10th and, you know, top half team on a technicality, like, they've got a handy run.
You say, am I right there, Gav? That sounds like the kind of preparation stat that you actually know well is correct.
It is correct, yeah. I'm 99% sure it's correct. Yeah, they've got a pretty easy run, fixture list. But look, maybe, you know, it now looks an inevitability, doesn't it? Especially when you see De Bruyne coming in there. And, like, they won that game without Haaland, without Ederson, you know, without John Stones. Like, that's most of the spine of their team, you know. So, I guess the only hope is that they have this easy run of fixtures now, but in March, when the Champions League knockouts start coming around, they do have as tough a run of fixtures as they could. You wouldn't say they're flat out difficult for them, because are there any difficult games for Man City? But on a relative scale, they are the more difficult games that they could play. So, you know, maybe some untimely injuries could derail them there. But at this moment, it looks kind of, there's a gathering in inevitability around all this.
Well, I was looking there, one for you, Shane. Probably a game you might want to try and get over to. Is it Spurs City 26 in the Cup of this month?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm good friends with this. One of my best mates is a season ticket holder, and I jump in when he's not using it. But needless to say, that's one that he is certainly going to be planning on heading to himself. So I have the slightly less glamorous game of Tottenham at home to Luton on the 30th of March is my next trip over. But on the upside, hopefully we get a few goals that day. And my young fella does like Ogbeni, so that's a plus as well. Assuming he's on the pitch.
When is that? Actually, going to just have a look. When is that? That's in March, is it?
I think it's 30th of March, okay. Is it?
Ogbeni, by that point, well, should know who his new international manager is. I don't know about you, Gav, I was making this point earlier. Like, in fairness, the FA are doing a decent enough job of keeping him close enough to where they're at here, aren't they?
Me and Chidozie Ogbeni are really looking forward to hearing, you know. I mean, trust me, listener, there's nothing me and David want to know more than who will be the next Ireland manager. But it's all very hush-hush, no leaks at all. This managerial search really doesn't have anything on the chaos of previous ones. The one before Trapp was appointed is probably the main one, when you had, you know, Dunphy turning into Venables on TV. Howard Kendall rang off the ball to pitch his wares. John Giles went to bat for Paul Jewell. It was just absolutely chaotic. We ended up with bloody Trapattoni.
I got a reply. From someone who, beforehand, and it was literally just saying no for like any word. No,
it's all under wraps. If I had to make a bet on who it would be, I would go with Carsley, but I, like, no information there, no insight, and no massive confidence in making that bet. Like, I mean, the question around Carsley is, like, you know, the vibes you'd hear are that, of course he wants to be Ireland manager. Does he want to be the next Ireland manager? We're not so sure. Because I think if Carsley wanted to be Ireland manager the day after he lifted the under-21 title with England in the summer, I think he would have been. I actually think that, I'm not sure Stephen Kenny would have survived those that defeat in Greece otherwise. You know, we have to kind of wait and see. But I mean, he would certainly fit the bill, Carsley, for the type of candidate that they're looking for, like a younger head coach, really, rather than an old traditional, old fashioned manager. And, you know, has been linked with championship jobs. But, you know, Birmingham and Stoke, those jobs have come up and they've gone again. So maybe that's a sign that he has a sight set for Ireland. But
well, you've kind of preempted my question there, Gav, because I was going to ask kind of the two of you that are in the industry, right? If Lee Carsley is going to be the next Ireland manager, why is Lee Carsley not currently the Ireland manager? I don't understand how he's not already in the position if he's going to end up in the position.
I think there could be an issue as well, and this is just about, like, salary is one part of it. Not that in terms of he's saying, right, I want this, but there could be some expectation now that there could be an increase in what they can actually offer the men's manager for the job. And then, I'll be honest, even just trying to kind of get a sense of the actual process of what's happening here. Was it Jonathan Hill had said that they've spoken to people, they've already made the contact with the people who they were interested in, and even over the course of the weekend, I'm trying to find out, well, at what stage are they at in terms of, have they actually zeroed in on, that's where I was like, got the response, no. Have they zeroed in on who they want, or is it still a case of there's still a couple of options? Do you know what I mean? That's where listeners, like, there's no point in trying to bullshit, like, people who are listening, like, at this current point, I couldn't say for certain that they've 100% nailed down and are at a point where they know and are down the line with getting everything in place for that manager or head coach. Which, like, Jonathan Hill did say as well, that, like, obviously there's going to be the friendlies in March, isn't it? And the draw. When's the draw, Gav? When's the...
8th of February, I think.
8th of February. So, like, he's already laid it out in saying that once they know who they're going to be playing, they want the manager in place or the head coach, so they can start prepping for those games, working towards those games.
Yeah,
you know,
I'd hope. I mean, in terms of, like, people are asking what's taken for so long, I know, but, you know, what's the rush again? Like, I mean, you don't need anyone for the draw. You don't need a manager there. Okay, like, the FAI will have to speak on the record about it at that draw if they don't have a candidate there. But, you know, from their point of view, I'd imagine they'll think big deal. You just want them in by March. You know, those double header friendlies against Belgium and Switzerland, you know, they're a hard sell to the public if there's no manager there, and it's a wasted opportunity because the Nations League in the autumn time is important, has been acknowledged as being very important by the FAI. So, you know, but that's not till the end of March. Like, that's a long way away yet. But yeah, it drags on. And listener, unfortunately, we don't know a whole lot as to what's going on.
Well, do you know what doesn't drag on is this podcast. So time is slightly against us. So the chat I was looking forward to having was actually about some of the championship stuff. I'm not gonna reveal who, but I'm looking forward to it.
Next week.
Well, actually, by next week, hopefully, I will have met two very promising young championship players who are Irish and are very interesting. Yes. But what is a month away now from the League of Ireland season started? I wrote the piece, and maybe I was being a bit mischievous, saying that there's a little bit of anger now in the title race. But Pat Hooban going to Derry, I'll be honest, I don't know, like you were slagging me earlier for maybe being a bit older, but this was a transfer that actually, it's just a little bit of giddiness, because I'm thinking, this is exactly what what Derry needed, this type of character coming into the club. If they're going to try and rein in Rovers and do something, I think this could be a big one, Shane. Because you know, Patrick.
Well, as I've said before, I think your initial phrase there was that it's a transfer that adds a bit of anger. Well, the name Patrick Hooban and anger certainly go hand in hand, in my opinion. I love him. He's one of the angriest men I've ever met. But I love him as a player. I think he is one of the few players you can sign who will just guarantee you goals. I do also think it's interesting that he's slightly modifying his position based on what I saw this year. I think he's getting ready for the latter stages where he might need to become a bit more of a 10 than a 9. I think he's starting to become a little bit of both. Previously, he would have, in my opinion, he would have stayed high and just waited for goal scoring opportunities, where he's now starting to come a little bit deeper. And I was really impressed with his passing range, actually, to be honest with you, and the bits and pieces that I saw with him last year. But there's no doubt, like, they were crying out. They were just crying out for somebody just to take the chances they were creating last year. And I mean, there's no better man in the league for doing that side of it. And it is, you're right, it's a brilliantly exciting transfer in that he's not, you know, some fellas could be involved in a somewhat controversial transfer, but be like really conscious of it and be trying to make it low profile and try to have it fly under the radar and all that kind of stuff. Hooves is not going to do that because he's super confident and he's absolutely not shy of conflict or any of those kinds of things. And I think it is going to add a really, really intriguing element to the season, no doubt about it.
Like, you mentioned that point about chances, and it was like I was on the Zoom call with Rudy Higgins and with Pahu when he was kind of announced, and like Higgins making the point that they average 17 crosses a game and they need someone who could actually be in the box to score it. But then also reference what you said there about has begun to Harry Kane his game, in the sense that they're dropping a little bit deeper. But also, and I took Higgins on his word for it, purely because up against that time. But he mentioned the fact that of Hoeven's goals, half of them have been the first goal for his team. So it's either been the goal to put his team ahead, equalise, or get his team maybe back in the game. So we're talking there about 30. It's that difference maker, you know, isn't it? Getting ahead in the game, not being the striker who maybe scores the second goal or the third goal in a comfortable win, but being the fella who wins you the game, or gets you that, nicks you that point in a game that maybe you haven't deserved to get it in. And that's what's let Derry down, even last year especially, was not being capable of capitalising when Rovers were in their slump.
Yeah, well, look, I think like if Hoobs was to have a catchphrase, like, it would nearly be kind of like, come at the hour, come at the man. You know, like, he wants high pressure situations. He wants to be the person who gets the headlines. He wants to be that, you know, other players will shy away from that level of expectation, I suppose, and stuff like that. Like, he's the perfect fit in that sense. You've got a club with a lot of money, a really good manager, and they're like missing one or two pieces to go on and actually potentially go and win a league title. Like, Hoobs is the sort of Hoobs, I am that missing piece. That's me, obviously. That's me. I'm that missing piece. Go on, stick me in there and I bet you'll win the league. Like, that is the way he will be approaching this situation, which I think is, as I say, I think it's going to lead to a really, really interesting one. Look, the other thing that I am keeping an eye on, because I have a little bit of insight on this, is we spoke before, I went across to Perth in the end of November last year. So I went for coffee and lunch and all that with Aaron McInniff, obviously, while I was over there. I think that's nailed on.
Cheers for the heads up on that, by the way.
That's the reason why you go for a coffee with these fellas. If you go for a coffee with a fella like that and it appears the following week that he's ready for a return to the League of Ireland, he's not going to have a coffee with you ever again, is he?
Joe hasn't been too bad with Joe, buddy.
No, look, the vibes I got off of Aaron when I was over there was, for me, it was just going to be a case, well, is it Derry or is it Rovers? I think it was almost inevitable that it was going to happen, and I think that is the case now at this stage, and it looks as though it is going to be Rovers rather than Derry, which is an interesting one. But I think he can be a huge addition. Like, he was been linked with breaking into he made two squads, actually, didn't he? Definitely made at least, I think he made two squads.
When he
was going well for Rovers. So, you know, he was a guy that was kind of banging down the door at that stage, and is still of an age where he still fits the right, you know, the right age bracket, that if he comes back and refines the form that he had before he went, he could knock on the door again. And he would be an equally massive signing for them as Hoobs would be for Derry.
It's just briefly on Hoeven is leaving behind. Like, obviously, long way to go before the season starts, and a lot of transfer business will be done before then, and Dundalk are behind the eight ball on it. But are they legitimately looking at a relegation battle at the moment?
Dundalk.
Like, yeah, because, like, I mean, it seems like maybe Shepherd is going to leave as well. I'll have to wait and see on that. But,
oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm being too dramatic there. But, like, you know, Galway coming up would be more competitive than UCD were last season. I mean, talk about Drogheda being full time has been a little bit premature. But, you know, that it's well within their power. Better way of saying it, we've seen their sticking power before. So I don't know, I'd be a bit nervous, like.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from there. Like, it is, I think the last I looked, I think the two sides that went up are currently, along with Drogheda, they're the three that are expected to be fighting out down around the bottom end. And, you know, I can put forward a reasonable argument why I think all three of those would feel confident about trying to stay up. So I would worry then for the couple above them, the Sligos and the Dundalks, are they actually going to be the ones that are going to get sucked down into a scenario like that?
Well, the other thing I'd say, what I would probably think would give, and don't get me wrong, there's teams, the fairest caliber of manager is strong, but, like, O'Donnell is a very good coach and a manager. Do you know what I mean? I think, don't get me wrong, like some of the players they've signed and brought in and obviously lost and maybe doesn't seem they're going to be retaining, it wouldn't fill you with a huge amount of confidence. But maybe a difference maker in possibly keep giving them the edge would be O'Donnell and what he's already kind of shown he's capable of with younger players as well and what you can get out of them, you know? I don't know. If I was a Dundalk fan, that's what I'd be kind of, I would be clinging to is the fact that they have got a really good manager there who can, but they've lost, we've just been talking about whom they've lost, like not just our main source of goals, but it does seem as if just that kind of character within the dressing room and the personality within it, you know?
Yeah, look, you can't make a much of a prediction on it until you see the squad lists on the first Friday of the season, but you know, I think it's fair to say that they're looking over their shoulders rather than up the league.
Well, that's a very kind of fitting, what's the word? I'm looking for the word here that's going to totally actually just ruin the whole flow of what I was going to say there. So I'm not going to even bother. I'm going to just finish off with the actual ending of the podcast on that point. Well, that's a nice way to end the podcast for Dundalk fans, Gary Gav. We'll make sure to get that clipped up and put it out. So Dundalk players have something to fight for this season. Shane, I hope you forgive me for annoying you earlier on.
Not at all. I enjoy it.
It has been lovely to speak to you, and I'll let you know if I plan to get my hair cut before the next podcast. So you see me, I think I might, to be honest.
Grow it back, David. Grow it back. You had lovely locks. Me, who can't grow them, is only jealous that you have the ability to.
Well, in fairness, I've seen Kevin De Bruyne's hair. That did make me think. Oh, tell you what, because even now Jack Grealish will be sick, and he hasn't even got the best hair in the City squad anymore. but anyway, I'm going to put the Crocs up and enjoy the rest of my day. Hope you do too, lads. Good to speak to you, and I hope you're keeping well.
Good luck, man.
Thanks very much.
Slope.